Good evening. Good evening. My name is Fabio Lucinius, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Women's Center, the Department of Women's and Gender Studies, the Department of Sociology, the Department of American Studies, the President's Office of Institutional and Diversity Initiatives, the Office of Diversity Initiatives, and the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's lecture, The Condemnation of Little B, New Age Racism in America. The case of Michael Little B. Lewis, to some extent, symbolizes current race relationships and the issue of black poverty and oppression in the United States. Little B is a young black man who was raised in a crack house in Atlanta, Georgia. When he was 13 years old, he was arrested and tried as an adult for murder that Brown says he did not commit. He was sentenced to life in prison, where he currently remains. This case and many similar cases of young black men being arrested and hustled through the system is arguably a new age version of racism. We are fortunate to have with us tonight, this evening, Elaine Brown, who is the author of The Condemnation of Little B, New Age Racism in America, and is the executive director of the Michael Lewis Legal Defense Committee. Brown regularly speaks on New Age racism and the necessity of eliminating racism, gender oppression, and class disparity. Elaine Brown is the author of A Taste of Power, A Black Woman's Story, in which she recounts her life in the neighborhood of Northern Philadelphia to her leadership role in the Black Panther Party, in which she was the first and only female leader. Brown is also the editor of Messages from Behind the Wall, a collection of autobiographical essays by black prisoners in New Mexico. In addition to her writing, Brown in 1996 established a nonprofit education corporation, Fields of Flowers. In 1997, she co-founded Mothers Advocating Juvenile Justice, and in 2002, she co-founded the National Alliance for Radical Prison Reform. At this time, I would ask that you please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Elaine Brown.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Don't get nervous because I reached under my jacket. Times get rough around here these days, aren't they? Stuff getting rough, folks walking around all kinds of crazy ways. Well, I want to thank you so much, Fabiola, for introducing me. And it's been a pleasure talking with you and a lot of the other students and teachers. I want to especially thank my friend and sister, Dr. Stephanie Gilmore, and thank the Clark Forum for inviting me here to speak to you, and happily see some of you had nothing else to do tonight and showed up. But in any case, I want to start out by just looking at some of the contemporary issues, because that's what I like to do. And somebody give me the, the hook. You know, I know who will. I'm not looking at you, but I will need the hook when my 40 minutes are up so you can ask questions or make comments or whatever. But what I'm thinking about right now before I start talking about Little B, which is really not the focus, total focus, it's really another kind of conversation. But in any case, one of the things I have been recently mad about, of all the issues going on in the world in terms of the day-to-day popular culture, is the Michael Vick case and how Michael Vick went and did 2 years in a joint, or nearly 2 years, over dogfighting and maintaining a dogfighting operation, and how people are still debating whether or not he should be given a second chance or anything like this. And then we find that Chris Brown can beat up a black woman, and nobody thought that he should have to go anywhere and do anything. Matter of fact, some people are saying, boy, it's really harsh, the amount of... That's okay. You can't hear? Well, that's nice of you to even... It's like weird to look people see. All right. Well, in any case... I'll just run back and forth, repeat the same thing. But in any case, the Michael Vick case is causing me some consternation, because I live in the state of Georgia, and just about every single Confederate trailer park got a dogfighting operation going, and none of these people has gone to prison over it. Matter of fact, most of them are being funded, or a lot of people, are being involved in it. So nobody got upset. Nobody gets upset in the state of Georgia, but all of a sudden Michael Vick has a dogfighting thing, and the whole world gets sends him to prison, and now we have a discussion about whether he's worthy of coming back to play football, as though football is some wonderful, as though that's not, you know, one step removed from warfare. And I'm also mad because I look at these PETA women. Now, the woman who is the head of PETA, her father was designed bombs during the Vietnam War, you know, but she didn't have any problem with her father being one of the designers of the bombs who killed all those people in Vietnam. But God forbid Michael Vick should be charged with maintaining a dogfighting operation. And, of course, they go on to talk about the dogs that may or may not have been killed, but not directly by Michael Vick. But whatever, the point is that here is Chris Brown getting community service for beating up a black woman, but beating up a dog gets you a couple years in the joint, especially if you're black. So it begins to kind of show us something about the question of race in the question of crime in America. Now, when Little B went on trial around that time, there was another boy named Jonathan Miller, who was a young white boy in Cherokee County. He was actually 15 years old, and Jonathan Miller was charged with bullying and beating some other little boy down at the bus stop and beat him up, and the kid died. He was a kid of about 13 or 14. And so they charged Jonathan Miller as an adult for murder and with a murder charge, same as the Little B charge. But the newspaper said, how can you put the same charge? They actually did this, compare Jonathan Miller to Little B, when Jonathan Miller he's really just a good kid that, you know, it was a bad result. He didn't really mean to kill that boy when he kicked him in the back and everything. He was being a bully. This is true, but he didn't mean to kill him. And right around that same time also, right when Michael Little B was going on trial, and I want to talk about his case in a minute, there was another kid in 1998, named Kip Kinkle in Oregon. Now, you know he was in trouble with the name of Kip Kinkle in the first place. You know your mother has named you Kip, knowing your last name was Kinkle. And your sister's name is Chris, you know. But Kip gets up, well, one evening he gets mad about something, and he blows his mother and father away, drags her father and mother down all underneath the basement, wires the house with some explosive, packs up a backpack with some handguns, has an assault rifle, tapes a hunting knife to his chest, 14 years old, goes off to the high school where he just started school, and lights up 25 people, three of them die. Now, we're not questioning that Kip Kinkle did this, because he did. Everybody saw him. He killed all these people, shot up all these people. And the next day, the headline, there was a banner in the school, and you know the scene, because we've seen it now. Everybody was crying. Oh, my God, this is so horrible. Everybody's screaming, the whole scene. And there was a big banner across the school, and it read, "Why Kip?" You know, it's like, why'd he do it? And the discussion rose as to, why did Kip do this? Was he, was it too many videos, violent videos, loneliness and exurbia? What is the problem with Kip Kinkle? But at no time did anyone even think to say that Jonathan Miller or Kip Kinkle might be thugs, you know, or criminals even. Everybody just wondered what happened to these good kids that had done these terrible things. And we began examining the same way we did with these young boys today. These boys that just recently did it. There was just a big thing on NBC and so forth about these two boys, the Alex and Derek King, 12 and 13 years old in Florida, and they were charged with beating their father to death when they were 12 and 13 years old. Now they've grown up a little bit, and when they went on trial, Alex and Derek King, they went on trial for murder, and then the jury came back, ironically, with second-degree murder conviction. And then their case was challenged, the judge actually reduced the whole thing through mediation to third degree. They went to a juvenile facility, and they are now out of prison. That was a 2001 case. Yes. So, now why do I say all this? Because race has a lot to do with crime in America, but I think the first thing we want to do is just think about crime for a minute and how we really think about crime and what is a crime, because we sometimes think it's a moral question, but it really isn't a moral question. It's really a political question, and I say that because we reward people when they kill people in Iraq. You know, we give them an award if you if you kill some people. Now, of course, in the case of that soldier, that 101st Airborne soldier named Green, who killed and raped a little 14-year-old Iraqi girl and then killed her whole family, blew her head off after he raped her, and his friends that did it with him, they raped her. He got life in prison for that, and the other two guys got 10 years to do for also rape and the assistance in the murder. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is crime if you can kill a 14-year-old Iraqi girl, rape her, and murder her, but you're not going to be given the death penalty? Whereas we look at a case like Tookie Williams in California, and we see that he was a so-called Crip, and therefore he got the death penalty, and Schwarzenegger went ahead and pulled the plug on him when he said, well, wait a minute, this guy's supposed to have been redeemed. You remember this film Redemption with Jamie Foxx? He says he's supposed to be redeemed and everything, but I see he's addressing, dedicating his book to, among other people, George Jackson, who is a radical, was a radical, a Black Panther prisoner. And this guy has addressed his book to George Jackson, so I don't think that he's been redeemed at all, and therefore we're not going to give him clemency. So how is it that you can kill Tookie Williams through the death, use the death penalty to kill Tookie Williams, but you give life in prison to a guy who kills a bunch of Iraqis who have done absolutely nothing at all, and which they admitted they had done nothing? So we had to look at, what does crime really mean? Now, looking at all of that, I came upon a case of Little B, just like everything else. I looked in the newspaper, and I was living in Atlanta, and 4 years before that, there had been a case of a boy named Yummy Sandifer, and Yummy Sandifer was a little Black boy in Chicago, and he was on the cover of Time magazine, and there was this little teeny Black face. Now, how many times have Black boys been on the cover of Time magazine? That would be zero, outside of O.J. Simpson. You really can't think of too many who had been on the cover of Time. And it was framed, and above it, it said, too young to die, too young to kill. And Yummy was 11 years old, charged, not charged with anything, actually. He had been killed by a gang, allegedly, you know, some gang in Chicago, because he had supposedly killed a little girl by accident as an initiation into the gang, and then the gang was afraid he was going to tell the police, so they killed him. At least that's the way the story wrote. But how would we know when Yummy was dead 2 days after this incident happened where this little girl was killed, in fact? So he was then identified as a super predator, some sort of a new breed, as was said in the article, quoting John DiIulio, who gave us the faith-based initiatives under the George Bush administration. Yummy Sandifer was some sort of a new breed of criminal, getting younger and younger, and well, as he, John DiIulio, and William Bennett said, and blacker, more and more Black boys becoming, in their book called Body Count. William Bennett, of course, the former Secretary of Education and now the commentator, whatever he is. I saw that Yummy Sandifer article, and I thought, how could someone put this boy and say he was a killer? The boy was 11 years old. We don't even know what happened, and he's dead, so we'll never put him on trial. We'll never know the facts. But he was already guilty, according to the Time magazine article. And that's what I saw happening to Little B. And I said, I can't just sit here and look at this. I have to do something. But here was the headline. It said, this thug, quoting the police chief, is charged with the murder of a good Black father. I'm going to tell you the facts very quickly, or the facts as they were identified in the newspaper. And so there was this picture of this little teeny face, the same face that's on the cover of the book. This little boy wasn't even 5 feet tall, and he was charged with this murder. Now, you know, throughout this information here, it says that I believe he is not guilty, as though, you know, I'm some sort of a bleeding heart, simple-minded liberal who just believes some little boy didn't kill him. I'm telling you that he didn't kill him because I know who the killer is. So for anyone to challenge me on that, I'll give you the name. You can ask that question. I'll tell you who did the killing. But this boy did not do the killing. But that isn't even the case, because it wasn't about a murder case. Because we already know, if it was about murder, we could have looked at him and say, what happened to little B? Looking at too many violent videos, let's examine what went wrong in his life. But nobody ever asked that question. And matter of fact, people don't even ask it today. They say, he must have killed that man, because that's what we're looking at, a Black thug. We don't call Kip Kinkle a thug. We don't call Alex and Derek King thugs, even though they beat their father to death. But we're going to call a little bit. So I was a little upset about it. So I looked at the so-called circumstances, and the case was that he was standing on a corner that was a well-known drug-dealing corner, and there was a little store there, and this couple drove up, and the wife was pregnant, and they had their kids in the back of the car, and all she did was go into the store to get a soda, and when she came out, and while she was in the store, this thug went up to her husband, Darryl Woods, and said, cut your lights. And Darryl Woods didn't want to do it. And because he was disrespected, Little B went and got a rifle and killed Darryl Woods. And that's the story. And that story was believable to everybody in Atlanta, including the black mayor, Bill Campbell, now in jail, or maybe he just got out. Bill Campbell, who said, I can't believe that a boy this young could commit such an act, a horrible act. Wasn't even on trial. It was like the second day that he'd been arrested. Everybody in black, you know, people call Atlanta black Mecca. Some people do. I'm not one of them. And some people call, you know, it's like black people are running Atlanta. Well, that would be in conflict with Coca-Cola Enterprises and Delta and Home Depot and all those other big corporations, in fact, run Atlanta. But in any case, the blacks of Atlanta were able to say what white people could have never said. And that is, this boy is an evil in this city, and we've got to get rid of this evil. Got to get rid of this evil. We can't allow these bad boys. Remember Jesse Jackson walking around sometime talking about every time I see a young black man walking behind me, I get nervous. And people feel that way. I have white women clutching their purses when I walk by. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, no, don't worry. You know, so it's just amazing. So everybody thought Little B was guilty. So by the end of the first week of articles, there was no question of his guilt at all. He was guilty. Nobody even thought, should we look at the facts of the case? Should we think about it a little bit? No. We know he's guilty. He's a bad boy. These little bad boys running around here, dope dealing and so forth and so on. So I went to see about the case. And one of the things first things I noticed is, why would anybody go to this store to buy a soda? Now, some of you may know this kind of story. You know, this is a store in the hood. You know when people tell black people that we're not eating the right foods. I'm like, you think you're going to be a vegan in the hood? You're not going to get no vegetables in the hood. You're going to get a pig's foot in a jar. You're going to get some old potato chips. You might get some weed. You might get some hair for your weave. But you're not going to get any fresh vegetables and fish. This ain't Whole Foods, okay? You're not going to that store to do anything but buy some cookies, some soda, some weed, but no, more than likely, you are in that community to buy or sell weed because that's all dope, because that's all that goes on. On that corner, you can buy crack. On this corner, powder, cocaine, ecstasy, you can buy it all. And who buys it? Well, gee, if it's there and I know about it and everybody seems to know about it, then how does it stay there? Don't the police know it? Oh, wait a minute. Maybe the police could be involved in this drug business. But in any case, this is a corner that everybody goes to for one reason only, and that is to get some dope. Now, the interesting thing is that most of the people who go to get that dope are Georgia Tech students and Spelman and Morehouse students. They call it up. You know, they drive through an SUV, roll up on that corner, you can get ecstasy. And they'll tell them, you need some powder, go right over there and get it from that guy. This is not like I'm making, and maybe some of you have heard of these areas or even seen them or even been in them. But these are high drug areas, and this is where this guy was killed. So right away, I became nervous about the idea of going there to look at it, but I had to see it. And then I thought, how is it that this woman and her husband and their two kids just happened upon this store in the middle of nowhere to buy a soda? It didn't seem logical, did it? Then I found out that they only had one light on their car. The other one wasn't working. So the question of turning out the light. Then there were overhead lights and the store had lights. And everybody who drives through has lights. So what's the big deal about turning off your lights? So right away, the story was weird to me. And then we find out that Kenya Woods, crying and carrying on about her husband dying, had just called the police for the 55th time because he had beaten her as he did for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And she said she was tired of him beating her up and she wanted him out forever. This is the clean version. So everything looked wrong. And eventually, I determined that there were some other issues just in the murder case itself and that nobody had looked at this because you couldn't even imagine that this boy wasn't guilty. Like the gun was 3 feet long, 3 feet and a half long, and the boy was only 4'11". I'm trying to figure out how he wielded a gun this big and how he came back because it didn't have an automatic reloading. A mechanism was broken, and so you would have to reload to fire 2 shots. I'm thinking, I wonder how this kid did all this, you know. 4:11. It's kind of interesting. So all of these things bothered me, but I wrote an article about it. And one other thing that bothered me is just how the whole community of Atlanta could condemn this one child. What was it about this? And I realized that this question of race, there are some black people who have started to say that, wait a minute, there is a difference. We are the good black people, and then there are these bad thugs and stuff, and we're ready to put them away just like everybody else. And so that became a part of it. And so, of course, he was tried and immediately convicted within, a couple hours. He had a 3-day trial. The jury, everybody admitted they had read the newspapers. Nobody tried to get them excluded, all that stuff. But anyway, he was sentenced to life in prison, which in the state of Georgia is a minimum, mandatory minimum, 14 years. He's done 12, almost 13 now. So when I looked at all of that and then I thought about it and I looked at where he grew up and so forth and so on, I got to realizing that the real issue here was that little B was really condemned from birth, you know. And I looked into his life. And, of course, as was mentioned, he grew up in the crack house. And when I first interviewed him, I said, well, how did you know your mother was on crack? You know, and he said, well, I saw the pipe, you know. And he knew what a crack pipe looked like and so forth and so on. And then I thought, well, how is it that you didn't go to school? Because when he was 11, his mother, he was declared a deprived child, meaning the mother was unfit to take, and they took him from the home, not that he had a home to be taken from, but they took him and his sister from the home. He had an older brother, a dope dealer. And he went to a foster home, or he went rather to a group home. He ran away from it, went back to what was familiar, which was the Bluff, the area that he grew up in, where this store was, where there's nothing but drugs. And so then he sold drugs from 11 years old to 13 to survive. He was a runner. He was a drug dealer. He stayed out all night. He did a lot of stuff that 11-year-old. And I thought, how do you grow up by the time you're 11 to find yourself on the street selling drugs to get food? How is that possible in America? And how is it possible that there even is all of this stuff? So I called the school and I said, by the way, did you notice that little B was absent for two for 2 years? Did anybody notice? Did you mark him present? Did you ever ask about? Did you ever send anyone out to find out about this book? No. Well, we had a fire and the records and the hoobie. And then I called the social services agent. Did you notice that he ran away from the group home and he hasn't been there for 2 years now? Did anyone ever go call the police? Did you send a truant officer out ever? We're short on all of these things. And then the social services agency said, you know, we are this is a boy who fell through the cracks. Because you know how we have this big safety net for all the children of America. And then this one just fell through the cracks. And then I went to the church and I said, did you notice this boy? He was right in front of your church selling dope. And he was only 11 and 12 years old. Didn't you maybe think to yourself, maybe I can help the boy? You know what I mean? And the preacher finally, they didn't want to talk to me. Finally talked to me because I was doing an article, I said, for Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which I was. But I didn't work for the Atlanta Journal. And I said, and he said, look, we didn't know him, you know, the way Peter didn't know Jesus, you know. So I said, so you didn't know him. So that's that. So I said, well, the real question is, it's Kafka-esque. You wake up one morning and you find that you are poor, you are living in the hood, your mother is a crack addict who will do anything to get it, your father is someone you met finally when you went to jail because he was in jail too, and he said, I think you're my son. And how does this happen? How do you grow up in a neighborhood like this? How come there are all these neighborhoods? And as I say, it's like a bad dream, but you can't shake it off. And of course, the real issue is that there is not just one little B, of course. There are millions of little Bs. Philadelphia, where I grew up, millions of them. In Philly, in Detroit, in Los Angeles, in Boston, you name them. There are all kinds of neighborhoods like this and all kinds of little Bs. They may not be living at quite that level. Maybe they're living a little bit above it, but there's lots of them. And so then you look at this question about how black people in America are living, because we don't like to talk about it, especially now in this alleged post-racial Obama moment. We don't like to talk about race in America at all. Now, we can look at the statistics. Some are in here. They're not the ones I like to talk about. I like to talk about 50% of the prisoners in America are black, when we represent only 13% of the population. 25% of the poor are black in this country. Black unemployment, double that of whites. We have the highest homelessness rates and the lowest home ownership rates. We have the smallest number of people with college degrees and so forth. Black infant mortality is the same as it was when Dr. King talked about it, double that of white. Black women dying of breast cancer and uterine cancer at quadruple the levels of white women. Black men dying of prostate cancer at double the rate of that of white men. As a matter of fact, black men having the highest prostate cancer death rate in the world, black men in America. Black-owned businesses, the revenues from black-owned businesses are less than 1% of the total revenues of business in this country. Now, how is that possible? Of course, I could talk about Hispanics and Native Americans. I could talk about poor whites, and I could talk about Asians and other people who are struggling too, but I'm talking about black people because it's so instructive to look at the incredible starkness of the situation of blacks. And I say this even recognizing that Obama is in the White House. The question becomes, is there something wrong with black people? I mean, how is it that we're in this situation that we're in today? Now, I actually have heard people tell me there is something wrong, and there have been studies done about whether there's a genetic relationship between being black and criminal behavior and so forth and so on. We can talk about that if you want. But on the question of racism today, we are now silent because Obama wants to turn the page, so we can't even talk about racism anymore. We said, hey, what's there to talk about? We have a black president, and that's the end of the conversation. But this president and this administration maintains a kind of neoliberal policy, which says, as was said yesterday in terms of that speech on education, that if you work hard, you can be anything in America. You just have to work hard. I always ask people, well, if that's the case, how many people work hard and are millionaires and really wanted to be millionaires and are not millionaires, even though they have worked hard? People go, oh, wait, what do you mean? Do you have $1 million? Most people who are in colleges today are here on loans and all kinds. Most people don't have a cash and carry college fund, you know, where mom and dad saved up all those years and were able to pay. I don't know what you pay to go to school here, but, you know, most of these private schools are pretty expensive. Now, all of this reminded me of a speech that Bill Clinton made in 1993, right after he was elected. You know, he was actually the first black president. You know, most people, a lot of black people like Toni Morrison and all kinds of people thought that Bill Clinton was the first black president. And they actually said, you know, Bill Clinton. So anyway, Clinton is standing at the podium in Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. King gave his last speech on this planet, you know, the great speech, you know, I've been to the mountaintop. I might not get there with you, but I'm not fearing any man tonight, that great speech. And Clinton is standing there and telling a host of black people that one of the problems we have to confront is what is really happening in the black community. And let's think about it. Let's imagine, he says, if Martin Luther King was standing by my side today, what would Martin say? And Clinton then goes on, Clinton, a guy from Little Rock, Arkansas, goes on to tell us what Martin Luther King would have said. And he says, Martin Luther King would have said, well, if he were alive today, why, I died for your freedom and look what you've done with it. As though, wait a minute, Bill Clinton would know the answer. And you, what you've done is there's high crime rate, all that black on black crime, all that breakdown of the black family and those teen black mothers. And he said, and Bill Clinton says, and all the black people said, oh, you're right, Clinton. You're right, Mr. Clinton. We bad. You're right. There's something wrong with us. There's nothing wrong in the scheme of things here. It's something wrong with us. We're not working hard enough. And Clinton says, well, I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you that three strikes crime bill. Make sure you get all the criminals out of your community so you can put them away forever. Of course, the population of the prison doubled from 1994 to 2004. And I'm going to give you welfare reform. These lazy girls laying up having all these babies don't want to work. I'm going to make sure they don't get any money unless they work hard. And that's the end of that. And all the people were happier to hear that. And then we have now the same concept. We've got to turn the page, Obama says, turn the page on history. Now, I lived in France for 7 years or so. And while I was there in 1994, there was a guy named Paul Trouvier who was a member of the Vichy government. You know, we don't even study the Vichy government, do we, in America? We go to school in America. I don't know what people are studying in elementary and school. They study no world history, no worldview, you know. And in any case, so Trouvier was a member of the Vichy government, and he was responsible for many thousands of French Jews being sent to Auschwitz, but he was caught on one case. And the French finally confronted their own complicity through the Vichy government with the Nazi regime. With the Third Reich and with Hitler and so forth. And so when Trouvier was put on trial, the French were like, oh, why are we putting him on trial? He's old. The war is over. The man is almost 90 years old. What is the point? Can't we just turn the page? You know, that's what we want to do today, turn the page. Let's not talk about all this stuff anymore. It's over. Turn the page. French prosecutor says, you're right, we must turn the page of history, but before we turn that page, we have to write it. In America, we have to write the page. We have not written the page about what happened and how black people got here. And all these people want to say, oh, it's some kind of bleeding heart thing. Now I want to just run through some of this very quickly because a lot of people get bored, but we can't get bored with what is going on. Because I remember when Clinton was asked about black reparations. He said, well, you know what, we can't really talk about an apology for slavery. And he said, we can't talk about an apology for slavery. It's too long ago. But I will every year have a celebration for Thomas Jefferson, and we'll have reenactments of the Civil War. But it's too long ago to talk about slavery. Oh, we don't. This is an unpleasant subject. We want to turn the page. Now, I'm just going to talk very briefly because I know my time is getting very short, but I want to make sure I do get some of the issues in that I really do want to focus on. And just go through how black people came here, because there's this idea that this is an immigrant country. You know, it's like the immigrants made this country great. What is Lou Dobbs talking about, you know? And then want to denounce some Mexicans talking about they're illegal. Like, who came here with some paperwork talking about, the Native Americans said, come on down, you know? Let me sign you up, and you just come on to Virginia, and don't worry about the 30 tribes that have been here for 10,000 years, Powhatan Confederacy, Pocahontas' daddy. We're going to invite you here. No, that didn't happen like that. It wasn't at Plymouth Rock that this country was founded. It is Jamestown that was the first English colony. So let's get that part right. We don't even have that part right. And after the complete annihilation of the 30 tribes of the Powhatan Confederacy, this country, Jamestown, became an official colony. Of course, it had been by that time. And, of course, that was the beginning of the importation of African slaves, as had been done in the Caribbean and elsewhere before, since Columbus. People go, oh, why are you talking about something in 1600? Because we just celebrated Jamestown's 400th anniversary. Why did we celebrate that? So Jamestown is one of the beginning of this. And, you know, at that time, they said it's estimated that over 80,000 of the English settlers in that area came from the prisons of England. Now, that began the slave trade, and everybody was in on it. Everybody was benefiting, you know, the triangular trade, going from Africa, taking the slaves, trading slaves for guns, trading Africans, and going over to the Americas, coming back to Europe with goods and cotton and farm. But it started out in Jamestown in the 1600s. And, of course, they found, even though they had come for gold, that gold was in tobacco, but they needed African slave labor. And so this is how black people came here. We did not come here looking for a better life, for freedom of religion, and for freedom of speech. We came here kicking and screaming on boats, and we were murdered, and all those other horrible things that we ought to know, but we don't study in school about the slave history of America. Now, by 1776, when the country is founded by the 13 colonies that are now united, they're united and they're founded because they have the money to tell England, don't need you, see you, not going to pay any taxes. We have some of the richest people in the world growing up right here in this wonderful country of the United States of America. So we are forming our own independent union, and we are declaring our independence. And these 13 colonies, every last one of them, had legalized slavery. And when they signed that Declaration of Independence, they created a nation that was a slave-holding nation. But don't let that bother us at all. The slave-holding nation, every single state legalized slavery, including Pennsylvania, where Benjamin Franklin himself had been a slaveholder. But we don't want to talk about that stuff because it's irritating to us. By this time, slavery had been institutionalized. Cotton was a big cash crop. Rice was even more. The South Carolina rice planters were making so much money, they had become a new class of rich people, which is exactly how America got formed, by that class that was the landholding, slaveholding class in America. Now, at that time, it was a crime for black people to be free. So when we talk about crime, let's understand it was a crime to try to be free, punishable by death on the spot or by return to your so forth. And so we find that this was an institution. 150 years is not just a moment. It is an institution of slavery. And by 1781, when Jefferson, who was a Francophile, decided that he would tell people, listen, you know, how can you talk about enlightenment and the equality of all men when you got slaves? It's even you, Jefferson. Quite a few, as a matter of fact. And Jefferson said, well, that's because, in notes on the state of Virginia, that's because there's a difference between the black and the whites. And that difference can be seen immediately in their color. That immovable veil of black is disagreeable, he says in notes on the state of Virginia. And their hair is not long and flowing like ours. And they have an odor that they tend to emit an odor, and they don't love, they lust after their women, and they have no poetry or music or intellect or writing in them. And he says, I advance it, therefore, that the black is inferior to the white in the endowments of both body and mind, and therefore we cannot talk about the equality of blacks and whites. That's what Jefferson said. So by 1861, of course, he was one of the big slaveholders making a lot of money. Other people, he made less money because he was doing other things with his money, but that's another discussion. But the bottom line was by 1861, the southern planters were making so much money, they were, in fact, richer than many of the kings and queens of Europe. And, of course, then the cotton question, the rice question became questionable, and there was this other, the rice question, because now there were other people selling rice in the world market, and so you find that the northern industrialists, in the meantime, there's this rising class of northern industrialists who recognize there has to be an expansion. They've got railroads ready, they've got steam engines. They can't really afford to have this whole slave labor. There's there's a shift from an agrarian base to an industrial base. And the South was, we're not going to lose our money by paying for labor. And the Northern industrialists who were on the side of the Union, like Rockefeller and Carnegie and Vanderbilt and all those boys, they were laying in the cut, as we say, to make some money. So by 1863, though, the South, who was so dedicated, they were winning the war. Everybody knows this stuff. You know this stuff. Now, why am I mentioning this? Because Lincoln says, wait a minute, they're winning the war. I'm going to issue an Emancipation Proclamation for the slaves in the seceding states. And I'm going to undercut that labor base they have from those slaves. And he says this is a necessary war measure. He doesn't say I'm for ending slavery. I'm telling you about a necessary war measure. And by 1865, the North was winning. Of course, Sherman ran through Atlanta and everywhere else. And finally, the war was over. And Sherman issued Field Order Number 15. How many of us even learn about Field Order Number 15? But a whole lot of black people know about it vicariously, because we know it represented the notion of 40 acres of land being distributed to former slave families. And when Sherman issued that field order, a whole lot of black people started running and grabbing up some land, and then the Freedmen's Bureau. But then Andrew Johnson came along and said, wait a minute, after Lincoln was killed, wait a minute, I'm not giving these black people these good white people's land. We're going to reconstruct the South. We're going to rebuild these lands. But these black people got to get off. The 13th Amendment hadn't even been ratified. And then, of course, there was the rise of the KKK to make sure these black people didn't think they really were going to be integrated into the United States, and eventually the black codes, which determined the behavior of black people in the United States. By 1882, in that 1 year alone, over 1 million Europeans began to come into the United States to work in the industries that were now rising because of this new industrial base. And where were black people in this? Well, by 1896, we know from the Plessy case that when the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, where the Supreme Court ruled that the way we would deal with so-called segregation or the disenfranchisement of black people or the inability of black people to have homes or have housing or have employment or anything else, the country couldn't be changed by law. The law would be, as long as the facilities were equal, they could be separate. And this came from a case of a guy riding on a train. And from that point forward, black people attempted to fight our way into just getting the things that we needed to live, housing, employment, education, and so forth. White people coming from Italy and Greece and all these different places were now white people when it came to black people. They hadn't been white. They had been, you know, German, French, whatever. But now they were white, and everybody understood. The one thing you don't want to do is have them come in. And so we fought. Booker T. Washington saying, let's just have our own economy. We had the rise of the NAACP. Let's integrate. Let's become educated and so forth and so on. And then you had Garvey's talking about independent economies and the sleeping car porters trying to get a union job, trying to get anything. The anti-lynching campaigns, the don't buy where you can't work campaigns, all this going into World War I, black people moving out of the South, trying to get jobs in the North. Henry Ford calling all the blacks in the South, come on to Detroit and help me build a car business, almost totally repopulated Detroit in a very short period of time. World War II, the second great migration, black people just looking for jobs. By 1954, we get to little Linda Brown trying to get an education. And of course, we know what happened with Brown v. Board. It hasn't been successful to this day. Its goals have not been achieved. As a matter of fact, America's schools have been resegregated, right? And then we had the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott that we all know about. And when we had the great moment of Rosa Parks, which had been going on in many other ways, but Rosa Parks saying that she, like Plessy in 1896, just wanted a seat on the bus. I paid for a seat. I want a seat on the bus. I don't own a bus. I don't own it, but I want to go to work, and I just want to get a seat on the bus. And then right after that, we have, of course, the rise of the voice of Dr. King and the moral voice calling America to task and saying, look, how do you call yourself a nation, the land of the free, home of the brave? All these terrible things are happening to this one group of people. And you had other people, of course, Malcolm X with the Nation of Islam. You had the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and CORE and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. All these black people since the time of 1865 saying, we just want to be free. Oh, freedom, oh, freedom, oh, freedom over me. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave. And so that's what you had. And then by 1963, of course, we all know about the March on Washington and Dr. King talking about having a dream. We all know what the dream was. Something about some little children walking over a mountain holding hands. We have never thought about what the dream was. We forgot how Dr. King was killed and why he was killed, because we think he ended in 1963. But, of course, we know he was killed in 1968 while organizing the Poor People's Campaign, talking about economic equality and talking about, interestingly, free health care. What a communist he was. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover did say that he was a communist. And talking about guaranteed health care, guaranteed income, talking about a redistribution of the wealth. That was truly the dream he had, and not anything about marching up holding some hands. In the meantime, you had the Black Panther Party, of which I was a member, and so forth. By the 1980s, these movements were basically wiped out by government efforts, mostly, and a variety of other things. And we had really the rise of the far right and so forth, end of the Cold War, all of this, until we come down to today. And now we see that we've elected a president who has called for change, and the first big act that has occurred has been this bailout of billions of dollars to big corporations such as AIG, the largest insurance company in the world, $182 billion in loans. Boy, I could use $182,000. Well, actually, I could probably use $182. But, you know, I mean, it's almost incredible to think that this is how we're going to start out this new moment of change. The war is intensifying in Afghanistan. You know, Dr. King called for an end to the war in Vietnam. He was against the war. Black Panther Party was too. But here we are, back at war, and intensifying, no less. We're not talking about a program of health care. We're talking about a program of health insurance. And it's just amazing to me that nobody has made note of that little detail. And blacks remain in the state that we've discussed with these things. And we're in a society where the majority of us, where the majority of wealth is controlled by a very small group of people in this country. So I just want to close by saying, asking the question is whether or not this is really what we want. Is this the society that we really want to have? And if it isn't, what might we think? How might we think about it? And I want to quote Dr. King when he asked the question after the 64 Civil Rights and 65 Voting Rights Acts were passed, and it seemed to be the success. And we had our civil rights after 100 years from 1865 to 1965. Now black people could actually vote, and we could actually drink water out of the same public fountains as white people and all those kinds of things that we gained at 1964 and 65. And so Dr. King asked the question rather rhetorically. He said, but where do we go from here? When I look out and I see what is going on in America, I see that the black has double of what is bad and half of what is good in America. So what's wrong? He says, where do we go from here? And I want to just quote and close with this quote. And King, of course, was a Christian minister. And so this is what he said. He said, you know, one day a juror came to Jesus and he wanted to know what he could do to be saved. And Jesus didn't get bogged down on the kind of isolated approach of what you shouldn't do or stop lying, stop cheating, so forth. So Jesus looked at him and he said, Nicodemus, you must be born again. And so King said, this is the same lesson that America had to learn. He said, in other words, quoting King now, your whole structure must be changed. A nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years, that will exploit them and poor people generally economically. And a nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and it will have to use its military might to protect them. And so what I'm saying today, Dr. King said, is America, you must be born again, meaning A fundamental change has to take place if we ever are going to address the questions of racism and class disparities and so forth. We will have to get past some of these ignorant arguments of today, learn to think better, and decide that we don't want there to be a million little bees in America. And so I think that's the message I have for today. Thank you very much. Okay, so if there are no questions, I'm going to the bar. No, okay. And I don't mean the law. Okay, so there are no questions. Come on. Yes, here's one.
Hello. Okay, so you kind of probed us to ask you about your proof or knowledge of how Little B wasn't the perpetrator. So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you already did kind of.
Well, the bottom line is he wasn't there. He didn't kill the guy. He didn't even know the guy. We have a witness that we presented not in the then case because he had a bad lawyer, but in the habeas petition we filed 2 years ago, we finally found this boy who was on a bike with Little B and talks about them riding. They were rough. These are rough boys, so it's not like we're trying to glamorize anything, but it's either one of two people who did it, and both of them were involved in it because Little B talks about it, and one was his brother, a dope dealer, and the main witness against him, a guy named Eric Mills, who testified against him and was that time facing 40 years to life for drug dealing, and who ended up spending maybe the next 6 months in jail and got out, and so those two together were involved in the murder of Darryl Woods, and I assume it was for, you owed a dope man, you got to pay. You know what I mean? Darryl Woods was no good father who got caught up in some terrible thing. So the whole scenario was miscast so that everyone believed. It was just a straight-up dope killing. This boy wasn't in it. But see, when you're the dope dealer and you think a kid can take the weight for it, and the kid has been used to taking the weight, but he was surprised on this one when he was arrested at his brother's house, since he didn't have a place to stay, he was. So we know that it was one of those two. And the reason I won't say that I think it was this one versus that one is because I don't want to make a charge. I'm not worried they're going to charge me with defamation. But they're too busy dealing drugs these days, and still are, by the way, right there on the streets of Atlanta. So, yeah, it wasn't a really complicated case. It became complicated because it was an example. And the black district attorney, Paul Howard, a Morehouse graduate, wanted to let the world know, it was his first month in office, that he was going to be tougher on crime than any white man in the state of Georgia had ever been, and he started out with the case of Little B. And so that was his political agenda, and he was very successful at it. As a matter of fact, after Michael was convicted, he got his office increased something like 30% in terms of the number of people in the budget and all of that, in terms of that, and went on to prosecute children as adults, even though he had the discretion to send cases to the back to the juvenile court. He never has sent one case back to juvenile court that has come before the Fulton County District Attorney's Office as a child. So, yes.
Hi. In today's society, would you view racist disparity or class disparity as worse?
Well, for black people, it's almost the same question. Because even though we do have Oprah and a few other people, in general, we fall into the working class, even though everybody likes to think he or she is part of the middle class, because everybody, it's like, when people ask what race you are these days, we're the only country maybe other countries do, but I don't know of one, really, that ask, identify yourself by your race or whatever. And so you have all these people, these Soledad O'Brien types that are now calling themselves not black, not white. They want to be in that other class, Just don't make me black, So the same thing goes for black people. I mean, there are very few of us who are not in anything except the working class. Very few. It's like numbers of people with PhDs, and even they are mostly in historically black college and so forth. But the class question is, of course, a very big question. And it's the question I would focus on, because I recognize when the Black Panther Party, I don't know if you realize, when we began to, we were a Marxist-Leninist organization. That doesn't mean we were a Communist Party with a capital C, however. But we did believe in the fundamental tenets of communism. And so as a result, we identified other groups of oppressed people. And so we coalesced, for example, with Browns, called the Brown Berets, an organization of Chicanos. And Mexicans in those days didn't want to be called Mexicans. People who were Mexican would be like, oh, no, I'm, you know, I'm Hispanic, or I'm actually Spanish, you know. But anyway, so everybody began to think of him or think of themselves. People began to think of themselves differently. And so we formed coalition with the Brown Berets of Chicano. We formed it with the Young Lords, Puerto Ricans out of Chicago and New York. And we also formed it with a group representing poor whites called the Young Patriot Party, believe it or not, out of Chicago, who were mostly whites from Kentucky, sort of what I call the left-leaning Timothy McVeighs, you know what I mean? And yes, that's right, Timothy McVeigh. But so they were, you know what I'm saying, arms strapped just like everybody else, but they had a left ideology, and we were all in that. And then we began to realize that we couldn't talk about the liberation of black people in the context of race if we didn't also talk about the liberation of other oppressed groups, for example, half the country. So the Black Panther Party was one of the first organizations, black organizations, to talk about women's liberation as a part of our agenda for black liberation. We talked about gay liberation. We were the only organization. We took some heavy hits on that one. People were like, wait a minute. I was going along with the Mexicans, okay? I was going along with all this other stuff, but this gay stuff, we ain't going with that. So we were, and Huey Newton issued a major paper, and people who are gay activists know that in 1970, Huey Newton issued a statement saying that the homosexual may be the most oppressed person in America, and that we saw gay liberation as a part of our struggle. We recognize our struggle was related to the Vietnamese people who were trying to have a struggle for national liberation, and so forth and so on, and we went all the way around the world. We even talked about so-called handicapped people, because we worked with something called the Center for Independent Living, and these were like militant people in wheelchairs who would like roll into a room and say, oh, I see, you don't have any access for me, let's start knocking some stuff down, you know what I mean? and they did, and ultimately we were part of that group, I'm proud to say, that really opened up the federal buildings, which then opened up all the other buildings for wheelchair accessibility and so forth and so on. We talked about the rights of seniors and formed the Gray Panthers, and so a lot of what you talk about today in terms of senior rights came out of that same era. So we recognized that our relationship wasn't obviously totally, but we also recognized that our subjective interest was the freedom of black people. But in order for our subjective interest to be fulfilled, we had to recognize objective conditions, and it was in our interest. If for no moral reason or ethical reason, but it was moral and ethical, in our interest to recognize the class relationships that we had with other groups of people, not only in this country but throughout the world, and I absolutely believe that's critical today. I know that it's critical today, which is one of the reasons why I've been one of the people talking most about this whole immigration question and how irritating it had become for me anyway, for black people especially, to be talking about the Mexicans are going to take our jobs. You know what I mean? I'm like, you haven't had a job in the last 12 years. I don't even know why you're talking about a Mexican going to take your job, because you don't have one. And so you don't realize that the Mexicans are not your enemy? What are you talking about? You know, pay attention to the history here. You know, so yes, we have to have a class understanding. And of course, I am, as I say, I remain ideologically committed to the whole concept of, I don't deal with socialism because socialism requires a nation to be transformed and then the nation becomes a socialist state and all that sort of thing. I do think, however, the tenets of communism are exactly what I believe, and I don't think they're inconsistent with the tenets of, say, Jesus Christ talking about when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was in prison, you came to see me. That people forget. They act like, oh, wait a minute, they can justify war in Christianity or war in, you know what I'm saying? So, yes, I think the class question is we can't afford to say we're okay with the fact that if you don't have the money and you haven't worked hard, your children can drop dead of cancer. What are we saying? Are we really, really willing to say socialism is the problem and we don't care if little children don't have health care? Are we insane? We're going to go to the gas station and see the little can, you know, for the child that's got the kidney transplant and they don't have, you know what I'm talking about, the little charity can that we always see. We don't mind that kind of thing. We're really willing to say, well, if you didn't work hard, you can be homeless. We're really willing to say that about other human beings. I don't think we are. And so I think that, you know, absolutely that the answer is in the fundamental tenets of what we could consider Marxism-Leninism. And that's where I do come down on the class question, absolutely. So, come on. Yes?
Hi, my name is Andrew Hill. My question was, what you seem to have been describing was something of a white privilege. And I was wondering that, in light of what our society is and in light of what someone would deem to be white privilege, where do we as a people go from here? And then where does society start its change?
I'm sorry. When you say I seem to be describing a white privilege, I'm sorry. I don't understand what you mean. Where did I describe? You mean you think this is the racism is a result of white? There's the other side of it is white privilege. Is that what
right,
you mean?
Right. From the systematic or the setup of what our society is, it seems like there is a white privilege from the descriptions that you made of just historical figures where Thomas Jefferson had
right.
slaves. And it seems like it's ingrained in our society. So where do we as African Americans go from here? And then where does society start its changes?
Well, if I had all those answers, you know, we would all be walking down streets of gold. But my analysis would be that, of course, there's white privilege, and white people have benefited from racism in America. And a lot of white people don't want to admit it. They say, well, we're poor, too, of course. I mean, aren't the Appalachian Mountains somewhere near here? You know, I mean, just run on up there, you're going to see, if you don't see it anywhere else. People working and struggling hard, you know, and but the race factor is just, you just can't deny. I mean, if you go to the prisons of America, the majority of people in prison are white people because the majority of people in America are, you know, generically white. You know, nobody runs around anymore saying, well, I'm actually a French American. So what I'm saying is that, yes, there is white privilege, but that is just one of the aspects of what this fundamental problem has been. We have been a people who have been enslaved in this country. We are an oppressed people. It's in the interest of everyone that we not be oppressed. Because our oppression is the fullest and the starkest realization of so many other oppressed groups, which is what I was talking to that young man about, in terms of Latinos, in terms of women, in terms of gays, in terms of all kinds of other groups of people that don't have the things that they need simply because they have been shut out of the society by wealthy, very ruthless people. You know, Bernie Madoff was just, I mean, this is like nothing. This is a joke. The SAC is the serious thing, you know. There was nothing that he did that was particularly unusual other than he just got a little greedier and got caught. Just like the AIG. You don't even know what that is. We don't know. What is the AIG? Started by a guy named Neil Starr, who was the uncle of Ken Starr, you know, the guy that did the impeachment on Bill Clinton. Here's a company this is a huge company, sixth largest corporation in America in 2007. So we have to find ways of having common ground, which is why I said the Black Panther Party said, listen, if you don't understand my oppression, then can you understand what you're going and can we relate to each other? Even if we don't do this. Now, people who think we can have a separate nation in America are deluding themselves. We're not going to have that. Dream is over. We cannot. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to organize among ourselves. We don't need to have some independent efforts, some efforts to have our own money. People say, well, how come the Koreans come here and they do, you know, the Armstrong-Williams conversations. Armstrong-Williams goes around telling people, how come the Vietnamese come here and they do so well? And black people must be lazy. You know, we say that about ourselves, don't we? And we always have that, like some inherent wrong with us. But Vietnamese people wasn't picking no cotton. 100 years. I didn't see nobody from Vietnam in the cotton fields of Georgia. You follow me? Nobody white was in the cotton fields either. No matter that they tell you about indentured servant. It wasn't happening. So this history has to be fixed in order for us to do the to do something. I, for one, want some immediate answers like I'll take some reparations. I'm looking for $40 million per descendant, okay? Like 40 acres. I'll take $40 million. But I would have taken what AIG got. Just get out to some black people. There ain't that many black people here. That would have been a nice hit for us, you know? But instead, no, we got to work hard and stay in school and don't wear sagging pants as though in the Bill Cosby new age of racism, we can say sagging pants are the reason why we don't have jobs. You know what I'm saying? So what about all the blacks who are college graduates, 7%, 7.5% unemployment among blacks with a BA degree who are not wearing sag, who are not sagging? You know, and how about the sagging guys who are making millions as rappers? You know what I mean? Matter of fact, they seem to be the only ones making any money. People with, you know, the Trick Daddy set, you know, whatever. I guess, you know, I don't like to talk about Trick Daddy because I like Trick Daddy, just so you know. Trick loves the kids, so I like Trick. He loves the kids. Don't get me started. But anyway, so I think, yes, we have to internally do some work. We can't be like a Henry Louis Gates talking about the two nations of black America and he lives in another one until you get arrested. You know, then you remember that you were black. You know, so we have to decide that there is a we in this and not go off into that individual realm where if I really work hard, I'll make mine and I don't really care about what happens to you. Or I'll give you some charity. I'll give back. You know, I'll give back when I make something. And that is also for everyone, I think. But as far as black people are concerned, my interest is that we do organize ourselves around our interests. But that doesn't mean to the disinterest of anyone else. It doesn't mean I have to include everyone. It just means I'm not trying to exclude anyone. But when I talk about black people, it's because I want people to remember what's going on and not pretend that you don't see it because you have a biracial president. Okay. So, yes. Where's our,
right here.
We lost a microphone. Oh, she's got a microphone. Yeah. There's another question over here later. Uh-huh. Sorry.
Okay, you talked earlier about how politicians and even gaps in the education system may...
I'm sorry?
How politicians and maybe even gaps in the education system may affect racial views. But it seems like...
I'm sorry, I honestly didn't understand what you said.
I have like a cold. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. I just didn't understand what...
You talked earlier about how politicians and gaps in the education system may influence racial views and stereotypes, but it seems in the case of Little B that a lot of people had already prejudged him to be guilty after they read a newspaper article or even maybe watched the news. So what role do you believe the media plays in furthering these stereotypes? And do you think the media is a maybe possible tool of politicians, or do you think it's just a reflection of our prejudgments?
Well, I mean, there's no question that the media are a tool of the rich in this country. You cannot get your opinion on CNN unless you got some money. If you want to buy an ad, there's a guy that comes on there that really drives me crazy, that guy that does that ad for, what is that thing with that, I can help you to get your, learn computers. I want to murder that guy. He makes me so crazy. It's on like every 5 seconds, this stupid guy with this, I can help you learn how to operate your computer. But if you don't have any money to buy that ad, all that you're thinking right now ain't going to be on CNN. So we don't even get that part. It's like, we have freedom of speech. No, you don't. You do not have freedom of speech. Unless somebody from Soledad O'Brien comes up and talks to you about being black in America, nobody's going to hear what you have to say about being black in America. You know? And Soledad O'Brien is not going to have a job if she starts talking about being too black in America. You follow me? So, of course, the media are make up the fourth estate. And, of course, now that we have, even with all the electronic and YouTubing and everything else, and there's something wonderful about that part of it, because the irony of life being that in order for you to make a lot of money, you could sell to a lot more people, but in order to sell them, you use this whole CIA-invented internet and all these machines and systems and so forth in place, and you've now invented this crazy kind of free speech thing, but then it's kind of spinning out of control because there's no movement to really give any kind of voice to anything. So everybody's just saying dumb and crazy stuff and doing dumb and crazy. You know, some stuff is good, some isn't, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But there's no voice for the masses of people in the mass media, period. You want to say something about, I mean, look at what has happened with the dialogue on health reform or so-called health reform. That here you had these old people sitting up here talking about, we don't want the government. Now you all on Medicare. What do you think Medicare is? I, who am also a Medicare, can tell you. And talk about overpriced, it's very overpriced, because I can tell you what, I went to a dermatologist or something, a long story about that. The point I'm making is yes, there is absolutely no question. These are the institutions of this country. If you want to have where is the black press? We don't, you know, what, Essence magazine? Is that still a black woman's magazine? I don't remember. It kind of is, isn't it? You know, it's like, you know, the Essence show, you know. But anyway, the point I'm making is that we don't have a voice for the issues that concern us. Because when we do these things, because they are not in the interest of the corporations, and the, I mean, I hate to sound like, you know, just so pedestrian about it, but that's just the bottom line. The corporations are not interested in this. Anytime you can give AIG, we are just sitting here right now, we have never even heard, most people never even heard of AIG. We don't even understand what $182 billion is. Like, it doesn't really translate in our brains. You know, if I said somebody spent $182,000 to fly from here to there and buy a jet plane, which that would be cheap, you'd say, oh my God, are you kidding? But $182 billion, we're like, what is it? We don't even, it's another universe. How does the government give this kind of money away? These people haven't repaid anything. Talking about they have come out of a certain, and then they want to blame black people for saying we are the reasons they have bad debt because we bought houses. You know that line, we all bought houses that we couldn't afford. As though that were really the issue, and it's so not the issue. But we don't know the issue because it's all being defined by the media, which is being defined by the people who pay for you to be on the air. Do you understand what I mean? In other words, how does Rush Limbaugh stay on the air? Because he has advertisers. That's all. Why aren't you and I on the air? We don't have advertisers. We can't buy airtime because that's what it is. So there's no question. How do we penetrate that? It's hard. I mean, the Black Panther Party had a newspaper. Our newspaper was a big newspaper at one point. You know, we sold it on the street. We sold it, you know, we sold it to libraries all over the world. You know, the Chinese alone had like 900 subscriptions, you know what I mean? I mean, literally, maybe 9,000. And so what I mean is, yes, that is that probably the most important aspect of how you sell, you know, is how you sell snake oil, is you got to, you know, get your cart out there, start selling snake oil, and that's what the media are in this country. I can't really, I mean, they're alternative media, but I mean, when we look at things like MSNBC pretending to have some alternative in Rachel Maddow and Kenneth and Keith Olbermann, whatever his name is, I mean, are you kidding me? You know, Rachel Maddow is promoting the idea of having, her biggest issue is gays in the military. She doesn't mind you being gay in the military and killing some women in Iraq. But just let's have equality for gays in the military, or not even equality, but don't ask, don't speak, knowing that it's all, in other words, saying it's okay to be in the army and go and kill some people as long as we have equal opportunity to being generals if we're gay. Now, I mean, is this a serious issue? Not to me, it isn't. You don't mind being in Afghanistan as long as women are running the drones. You know what I mean? How crazy is that? And that's the biggest, that's the most liberal voice on major, I think it's, wouldn't you say Rachel Maddow is probably one of the more so-called liberal voices? And she made that her biggest issue. I was like, if you say one more thing about gays in the military, I'm going to go through this TV. And you know how unproductive that would be. You know what I mean? So, yes, you're right. The media are the worst, probably the biggest, well, it's the propaganda machine, we would say, propaganda, because I don't see any other voices out there at all. And, I mean, look at this guy, Jones, this guy from Oakland. I don't know him, but I know a lot of people who know him. And now he's backing up saying, I didn't really sign up to. Now, you let Glenn Beck single-handedly transforms the government and has this boy fired. How deep is that? Do you know what I'm talking about, the Van Jones case? You do or no? Young lady, no? He was a black guy that was Obama had appointed to some, not a cabinet level, I guess it's a head of a bureaucracy for environmental, trying to get jobs, environmental jobs, right? Because he had been doing a lot of environmental stuff in Oakland, around the black and poor communities, as opposed to just, you know, the kind of other kind of environmental interests, right? And he had been appointed by Obama, and Glenn Beck, the guy out on Fox News, who has a big show, is like the junior Rush Limbaugh, and he went on a little campaign, and this guy is now gone. That's my only point, is that how fast that went down. That would have never happened in the other way around. You know what I'm saying? So, all right, do we take one or two more questions? Yes. Wait.
Question?
It's just one more? Okay. Well, but can we take this? You don't care? All right. Because I was going to take two. I was going to override her. Yes.
Thank you.
Is this going to be a good question? Because this is the last one. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm kidding.
I suppose we'll have to see. I appreciate this this statistic here where it says in 2005 there were 530,000 black males ages 18 to 24 in college, and that is more than the 193,000 black males ages the same age who were in prison. And the reason I appreciate this is because this past summer I read this book by Frederick Douglass called My Bondage and My Freedom. And in that, he said, ignorance is a high virtue of human cattle. And I wanted to know what you think us as the youth of today could do to try to emphasize these kind of statistics to let other youth out there know that you can go to school and education is available for you. Because, I mean, I've met quite a few people who just give up because they think that it's not for them.
Well, this first of all, let me say this. I didn't print this statistic. I wouldn't have chosen to print this, and I certainly wouldn't have framed it in the way that it's framed here. Is this to say everybody's complaining, but let's look at how many wonderful things are happening. You've got 530,000 black males. I don't even know. It's claiming it's from the NAACP. I'm not so sure about that number because there has been the other statistic that people always say there are more black men in prison than in college. And so this is to refute that. That was the purpose of this being inserted here, to refute the notion, so that you can say, well, look, we're doing better. And it's also to suggest that if you had stayed in school, you wouldn't be in prison. Don't you think that's the kind of suggestion of this statistic? Like, if you had just stayed in school, you would not be in prison. Now, that's the conclusion that we come to, isn't it? So let's think about Little B as an example, because it's easy to think about him. Now, people actually said to me, well, when he was 11 and he ran away from the group home, he could have gone to school, but he chose not to go to school. Now, when you were 11, and you're a young man, young black man, nice looking, did you get up in the morning at 11 thinking, gee, I just can't wait to go to school? Or did somebody have their foot on your neck, huh? No, I just want to know how you felt about school when you were 11. Okay. I mean, are there a lot of young men in here, black or otherwise, who at 11 years old would have the choice? Let me see. Should I go out and play and eat candy? Or should I go to school and do my homework so I can grow up, too, to be president? Now, how many 11-year-old boys, I'm just trying to think to myself, could really say, I would prefer to get up and go to school? What's the reality on that? Probably zero, okay? And the two people who would say would probably be lying. Because they fixed up their history, right? Most boys at 11, they just came out of stop wearing a cape. Am I right? How many people? Come on. Now, you know you guys had capes. You know what I'm saying? Guys had capes, okay? Guys like capes. They like to jump. You know, most girls would like just step down the three step, walk down the three step. But guys would like jump, get up from the thing, and then jump off the thing. Now, I'm trying to think, who is staying in school? But now let's add in the hood. Let's add in, oh, is your mother smoking crack? Now, I don't believe your mother was smoking crack, was she? And what about your father? Did you actually know your father? He was a kid who never met his father. He didn't actually think about it because it didn't matter. His brother, his older brother, was more like the parent, and his brother was dealing dope. Now, how did he come to deal dope, his brother? You know, I tell young people your age, I didn't know anyone when I was growing up in North Philadelphia, 21st and York. Anybody from Philly here? You know where 21st and York is, don't you? That's the deep hood, ain't it? I'm from Philly, where I am from hood, is it? Am I right? I did not know one person on crack. And you know why? There was no cocaine. Rich people couldn't even afford cocaine in those days. Cocaine was expensive. We bought cigarettes for a nickel for three. That's deep, isn't it? And that was like our little thing, and we smoked them with a bobby pin the way people, I'm sure most of you don't know about a roach clip. So we smoked cigarettes like this. And if you were lucky, you could get a hold of some cheap Gallo wine. And that was your high. Or you buy some kind of, the guys would drink some kind of, what do you call it, cough medicine or something. Somebody's 40 or something. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, nobody had drugs. You know why? We didn't have any drugs available. You heard about people using heroin. They were in like the jazz club. You know, they were like big time people, you know, it's like Bird or somebody like this. But nobody had any heroin in my neighborhood. So it's not like we were good people. We just didn't have any drugs. How did it happen that we didn't have any drugs in my generation and nothing but drugs? You don't, all, I bet you everybody here knows somebody's been on crack. Somebody said no. But you know what I'm saying. We know about drugs a lot now because, and where did that come from, you ask? Now, you know, all cocaine basically comes from Colombia, Bolivia, or Peru, right? Now, when's the last time you knew any black people were flying planes back and forth from Colombia and Peru? We ain't had a piece of transportation since Marcus Garvey, okay? We don't own any airplane companies. Trust me on this one. So, how did those drugs get from Colombia and Peru and Bolivia into 21st New York? When nobody from 21st New York Street is from there and can't, you know they can't speak Spanish. So then you wouldn't even be able to land, you know what I'm trying to say? And then they're like, what? So I'm saying there's something wrong with that too. So add in the factor of cocaine, add in the factor of poverty, and then let's look at the school in Little B's neighborhood, English Avenue. Now, let me see. How many of those kids are in a classroom at a time? Well, I can tell you a lot of them don't have a seat in the classroom. They don't have enough chairs. And sometimes the building is leaking and all these other things that go on in poor people's schools. Now, this stuff is real. This is not Elaine Brown conspiracy theory. It's old, radical, crazy, revolutionary, something like this coming up with some old 1960s rhetoric. This is some real stuff right now. Just go to any school in North Philadelphia and see what you're going to see inside that school. So we add in this factor. By the time you get to the second grade and you're a black boy in America in that school, you're already pegged for the jail. You're on the pipeline. You're ready to roll on straight through. And nobody's going to say. So they say, well, what about the parents? The parents aren't doing anything for their children. You're right. Little B's mother was on crack. She did not care if he did his homework. No, she wasn't going to go over lesson plans. As he says, she smoked up the water. She smoked up the heat, the food. No, she took whatever money they had coming in and she smoked it up and put it on her. Now, you can be mad at her. When I say you, I don't mean you personally. We can be mad at her. I'll just assume kill her as think about it because I'm so angry right now. But will it change what happened to him? So what point is it to tell him, you should have stayed in school, little bit? Are you insane, not you? What do you mean he should have stayed in what school? Where was all this stuff that would have been better? Does this mean we don't want to be educated? Of course not. But it does mean that people like you and me have some duty to make sure that the gap between little B and some of us and a larger group of people is filled. We know that the money is not rolling into the public school systems in the hood the same way it's rolling into other neighborhoods. That's just the reality. Tax base is what on? Based on property values and all this? Ain't no property. My aunt just sold about 5 years ago, that is, she sold our house at 21st in New York for, would you like to know, Miss Philadelphia? Would you like to just imagine how much she got after she worked all her life at RCA Victor, scrubbing floors? This was not some lazy woman who wanted welfare, and nobody in my family didn't work. Everybody worked. She sold her house, the one thing she had, for $13,000. Am I lying about this stuff? You know what? Am I right about that price? And it's incredible, isn't it? $13,000 is your whole life. And she had the nerve enough to say, I had to put that money because I didn't want to buy. I'm like, this is not even a car, okay? Your house, your whole life that you worked to pay for this house is now over. Now, if we don't understand these objective conditions and we imagine if we fix ourselves, it'll all get better, it's not going to get better. We do want to work and go to school, but we also want to go to a school that's teaching us something. Most people here had to learn a lot of the history of this country as they came into this school. didn't get any good information in elementary school. Most people in college are really not good writers. I can tell you that, right? All that, been too so used to that email, what is that, the text message talk, can't even spell anymore. You know what I mean? I see these college papers. There's some rough stuff. I know some of these professors out here know what I... See, I would be failing a lot of people just on grammar alone. No, really, I really would be failing people on grammar. There's a lot of bad grammar in these in this school, I'm sure. I'm sure I can get a professor to give me a... Can I get a witness about some bad grammar, okay? So what I'm saying is, yes, the idea is of course we want to be informed, but we don't want to be misinformed. We don't want to be celebrating Thomas Jefferson and not know that he was, in fact, a slaveholder. Let's not act like that didn't happen. So we want to be informed, and then we want to say, what is the value of education? Is it just for me to be on track to go to this school so I can get a job? Is that my whole life? Like, the only reason I have to declare my major now, because if I don't do that, then I won't get on track, and then I won't get the business opportunity. Because aren't there in these schools these people that do career advisors or something? What do you call those people? You know what I'm talking about, career people, right? And they're there to get you in so you can match yourself up with a job. I don't know that. I used to go to school, think you went to school to be enlightened and informed and educated. I really believe that, you know. I went and took liberal arts in school. Do they have liberal arts anymore? Does that exist? Huh? Oh, that's you? You're liberal arts? You mean the school is. But we didn't have to say, I'm a major in. You say, we just graduated with liberal arts. You know what I mean? We didn't have, like, I'm an English major. No, we didn't do that. You had to study a little of everything and know some stuff. Yeah, I understand what you meant. But I meant, you know, that declared major stuff. We didn't back in the olden days. So I guess what I'm saying to you, young man, is that you are right in the sense that we do want to be educated. And it's our duty, therefore. The Black Panther Party believed it so much, we started a school. And we had not just an after-school program to help the little children in the hood learn their math lessons. When you got to go back to the hood, you really don't care about math. You know what I mean? If mom is smoking crack, it's going to be hard for you to focus on, and you don't eat any food except for when you go to school, it's hard to focus on your career development. You know what I'm saying? So if we don't change these other things, the notion of just saying, stick to it, be in school. Because when I look at Michelle Obama, yes, her father was a working man, but her father was very close to the deli machine in Chicago. Let's get it right. Let's not pretend you just worked hard and this all happened for you. It didn't happen like that. So what I'm saying is, if we want the masses of our children to be educated, then we need to probably do what that brother was suggesting, meaning we need to create some stuff for our children because we can't wait for this to all be fixed from above. And I think that would probably be the biggest lesson for those of you in this school. You all have the hope. And if you don't mind my saying, as Mao Zedong said, you young people, you are like the sun at 8 or 9 in the morning. You are the beginning of a new life and a new generation. And it really is on you. Ain't nobody coming to save you or save us. That's the real lesson. And so if you can start a school, and if you can say, let me lift up this young brother and put my foot on him the way my mother did me and make sure that he goes to school and does his lessons and gets some food and maybe get some clothes, because he really, I know that Miles just finished with this. Michael told me, he said one of the reasons he was angry a lot, and he was angry a lot as a child, is he really didn't have any new sneakers. Do you know what I mean? And everybody who's young knows what that means, to not have that stuff, you know, that other people have and that you want, you know. It's not maybe that big of a deal, but now you don't want to go to school, or you want to beat up the guy that's got the sneakers or all that other stuff. So if we just kind of even the playing field, then we might be able to even out the numbers, not going to prison and so forth. And then there's changing the law so that people don't go for such frivolous stuff as some people are in prison for, you know, smoking a joint, you know, carrying a little bit of cocaine. I mean, this is not worthy of 10 years in prison, and that's what people are getting for a lot of these, you know, dope charges. So those are the things I think we have to look at in addition to just saying be educated. I absolutely believe in education, and I will close with saying this. When I went to school in Philadelphia, I grew up in one, as I say, one of the worst neighborhoods, and we had 60 children in a class in my neighborhood school, 60 children in a class. And my mother refused to do it, and all kinds of other things happened. But anyway, I ended up starting kindergarten in a so-called special school, experimental school called Thaddeus Stevens School of Practice. And, of course, I was one of the three or four colored children, as we used to say, in the school. Everybody else was, well, there were like 2 Puerto Ricans, 3 Chinese, and a gypsy or something, you know what I mean? But everybody else was white. No, not just white, Jewish. So Jewish that we never celebrated, we didn't even have Christmas in our school. It was a public school, but we had Hanukkah and we had Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we all became, by first grade, we were all Jewish, and but we could read. Trust me, we could read. We could read. And the only difference between those of us who weren't Jewish and the Jewish kids was that they went to their real school, which was Hebrew school. You know what I mean? So anyway, but this school did one thing that was critical in my life and distinguished me from all of my girlfriends and the guys I knew. Every girl I knew just about was pregnant at 14. This teen pregnancy ain't new. You ain't got nothing else to do. You get pregnant. You know what I mean? You lay up, you get pregnant. You're 14 years old. They were pregnant. My friend Barbara, she went to my school in the fourth grade. But because I could read by the first grade, I had something that my other friends didn't have. I had the ability to imagine. I had the ability to think in clear ways that I wasn't just angry about this. I could actually articulate that. And reading was so important in my life. But what did it take for me to go to a reading school, to a school that taught me to read? It took me getting out of the hood. And then I had to figure out that I wasn't really white and Jewish as I became by the time I was in the fourth grade. I was actually like speaking with a little bit of a Yiddish accent. You know, we had a teacher in my school, Mr. Silver, and we read in fourth grade, we read, I've forgotten the author's name, the poem, The Highwayman. Does everybody know The Highwayman? People who know poetry and it, you know, it's like the highwayman goes riding over the purple moor. And Mr. Silver had such a heavy Yiddish accent, we got the highwayman. So all of us were learning this poem like this. The highwayman goes riding over the purple moor. Best. And we were like little Jewish children. So, but I love this school because I learned stuff there, okay? But I had to go back. And what I hated was going back to my home, to my own people. I hated that because they were poor. So I was white and Jewish during the day. And at night, I was black and from the hood and became very, very confused by that. So what we want, though, is to transform that and make that available to all of our children. What happens at Phillips Exeter, we want that to be available to everybody. That's the best education, so we want that. It is not available. And until it's available, we can't ask these children to somehow overcome all obstacles, poverty, hunger, and so forth. Because if you really overcome it, let's not have all these obstacles. I guess that's the lesson I want to say. Anyway, you've all been very, very kind in listening to what I had to say, and I appreciate being here. Thank you. So what, you're closing out?
Yeah. And that concludes our evening. Thank you for coming, everyone.
So much for the speech.